Welcome to Texas True Crime. I'm your host, Jessica. I'm so glad that you're here with me today. I want to apologize to all of y'all for being late. I had some technical difficulties that threw everything off schedule. So when I sat down to start typing up our episode, my computer said it needed to update. Okay, no big deal. I didn't think much about it, but apparently I had let it go way too long. I don't know if any of you ever do this. You just see updates needed and you just keep ignoring it every time and think, I'll get to it later. I'm the queen of that. I know I'm not supposed to do it, but I always do. And it really came back to bite me in the butt this time. Well, the updates took way longer than I had planned. And so when the updates were done, I thought, all right, now I can get back to getting things ready. Oh no, then I couldn't get online. So I started trying to figure out why our internet wasn't working. Why wasn't my computer connecting? And then I got a text from Spectrum that we had an outage in our area. So needless to say, the recording gods were not with me. And I apologize. So I want to say thank you all for being patient. And just know that I appreciate each and every one of you. So enough of all that and my recording drama, let's get to the good part, today's episode. Peggy Jo Tallis was the last person anyone would suspect of robbing a bank. Her niece said that whenever she was behind the wheel of a car, she never drove over the speed limit, that in fact she usually drove under the speed limit, and she stopped at all the stop signs with a complete and full stop. I don't know about y'all, but that right there says a lot about Peggy Jo overall, because I am the world's worst about rolling up to a stop and looking both ways. And if no one's coming, I just cruise on through. Yes, I stop enough so I can see, but the full stop where your car comes to a complete stop and you actually pause for a moment, I'm not always that good at. So, Peggy Jo, obviously a conscientious, safe person. But here's the thing. Peggy Jo liked to rob banks. And starting in May of 1991, she robbed multiple banks and kept the FBI guessing as to who was really behind the bank robberies in the Dallas area. And at the time, they were convinced that they were dealing with a professional male, not a female bank robber. Peggy Jo wore a disguise. She dressed as a man. She never spoke a word. And her disguise was so good until she was finally caught. Everyone, including the FBI, thought Peggy was a man. And they dubbed her Cowboy Bob. In fact, her only tell that something was amiss was that she always wore her cowboy hat backwards. When Peggy Jo was finally caught, over a year after her spree started, the FBI initially thought they were talking to Cowboy Bob's girlfriend, not Cowboy Bob himself. So, Peggy Jo hadn't always been a sweet little lady who wore khaki pants every day and took care of her sick mother. When Peggy Jo Tallis was a teenager in the late 1950s, she was a free spirit who loved adventure and wasn't afraid to seek it out. She was born June 6, 1944. She was the youngest of three children. When Peggy Jo was 4 years old, her father died of cancer, and her mother, Helen, found a job as a nurse's aide to support the family. The family lived in a small rent house in Grand Prairie, Texas, a suburb of Dallas about 20 minutes away from the city. In high school, Peggy Jo's siblings were overachievers. Her sister Nancy was the high school majorette, and if you're not familiar with what a majorette is, they usually twirl batons, rifles, or flags, sometimes even fire, and they combine dance moves with the marching band at, you know, high school football games and during parades as well. So the majorette is the center of attention. And if you think about a parade, if you ever see a band coming down the street and there's that usually girl in the front who's waving her baton and marching along, doing the moves, that's the majorette. So, you know, front and center. Then her brother Pete played on the district's championship basketball team, and both of her siblings made really good grades. Peggy Jo, on the other hand, dropped out of high school after the 10th grade. She told her friend Karen that there was too much else to do in life than spend so many days at school. Peggy Jo just wasn't interested in conforming. One day on a whim, Peggy Jo jumped in her car and drove all the way to San Francisco on her own to see what life was like there. She returned after a few months and gave her friend a book of poetry that she had picked up while she was in San Francisco. When Peggy Jo was just 17, she moved to Dallas, got a full-time job, working as a receptionist at a Marriott hotel near downtown. She also got her own apartment. She made friends with another pretty receptionist named Cherry, and the two young women loved to go out together almost every night. Peggy Jo always drove her little Fiat. She loved to gun the engine and race with her cars from stoplight to stoplight as they were driving up and down the street. And Peggy Jo and Cherry hit all the top spots at the time. They drank beer, played pool, flirted with cute guys. I mean, they were young, in their 20s, having a good time. And they also went to see bands like The Doors, The Doobie Brothers, and The Rolling Stones. I mean, they were having a big time in the 60s, y'all. Now, they also liked to go to coffee houses. Remember, Peggy Jo spent some time in San Francisco listening to poetry, so she liked to take Cherry to coffee houses, and they would listen to poets read their original poetry. And Peggy Jo loved to go to the movies. Westerns were her favorite, and the one that she liked the most was Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. If you haven't seen it, I highly recommend it. And from everything I've read, it was Peggy Jo's favorite. I can understand why, too. It's a great movie. So the movie, if you're not familiar with it, it tells the story of the well-known bank and train robbing team, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Now, the two believe that they were what they were doing was okay because they never hurt any innocent bystanders, and they always robbed from institutions that took advantage of the less fortunate. So Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid kind of thought of themselves in this Robin-esque kind of light. Robin Hood-esque, excuse me. Now, Butch and Sundance knew that eventually their luck was going to run out and they were going to get caught. But in the end of the movie, they go out on their own terms. Now, Peggy Jo wasn't interested in getting married and settling down. Remember, she didn't want to conform. And this kind of was across the board in everything Peggy Jo did. Well, you know, it's the early 80s now, or getting close to the early 80s. And Peggy Jo, she didn't want to get married, settle down, and have kids. She was still interested in having fun. And she really wasn't career-minded either. Her main goal was to make enough money to pay her bills and then have enough left over to go out, have a few drinks, and catch some shows. Her one dream was to one day live on the beach in Mexico and wear bathing suits night and day. She told her friend Cherry that she was putting money away so that one day she could fulfill that dream. Friends described Peggy Jo as beautiful and rambunctious. She had pretty gold curly hair and big green eyes, and according to one friend, movie star legs for days. They also said that she was wild at heart. So, by all accounts, it sounds like Peggy was fun and adventurous and also really nice. Like, she was someone you really wanted to be around. And, you know, she really was wild at heart. I mean, all the stuff that I already told you about, jumping in the car, heading out, not wanting to conform, doing her own thing, she definitely knew who she was. That's for sure. One day, Peggy Jo was pulled over for speeding. And when the officer handed her the ticket, she laughed and tore the ticket up in his face. On another night, she and Cherry got into an argument while they were out. Cherry walked down the street to another bar to calm down. Peggy Jo, on the other hand, walked out of the bar and saw a truck parked on the side of the street with the keys still in the ignition. She jumped in the truck and took it for a joyride. Now, the police caught her, and Peggy Jo pleaded guilty to a felony charge of unauthorized use of a motor vehicle. She received 5 years of probation for that. So, again, she was totally doing her own thing. I'm not saying you need to go out and jump in a truck and drive it around, but it was like she wasn't afraid to just do things on a whim. That was how she was. When Peggy Jo was in her early 30s, she fell in love with a man who lived near Dallas. They dated for a few months, and Peggy Jo told her friends that he was the love of her life. However, Peggy Jo found out that he was a married man, and she was crushed. You see, she wanted to go surprise him, so she drove to the other town where he lived in and saw his car parked. So she pulled up, got out of the car, and then there was a woman sitting in the driver's seat. And she asked, "Oh, what are you doing in old so-and-so's car?" And she said, "Well, I'm married to him. I think it's okay if I sit in his car." Peggy Jo had no idea that she was dating a married man. She couldn't believe it, and she felt horrible. So pretty soon after that, Peggy Jo moved into an apartment in Irving, another town that's just a short drive from Dallas. In fact, they like their boundaries butt up to one another. And she moved in with her mother, who had a degenerative bone disease. The wild child found a new job at a computer factory and became her mother's full-time caretaker. And most of her friends say that, you know, that experience with the relationship just kind of crushed Peggy Jo. And that after that, it kind of took the wind out of her sails. Well, Peggy Jo and Cherry would still get together from time to time for a wild night out on the town, but of course not near as often as they did before. After all, Peggy Jo is her mother's full-time caretaker. And her disease would just become progressively worse. By 1980, Cherry had gotten married and moved to Oklahoma City, and Peggy Jo's other girlfriends had also gotten married. But after the relationship with the married man, Peggy Jo kept her distance from men. All of her friends said it was like after that, she wasn't interested in dating. It was kind of like she just never really got over the hurt of that betrayal. Her friends said that for a time, Peggy Jo settled into a routine. She went to work. She came home. She took care of her mother. And then she got up and did it all over again the next day. When 1984 rolled around, Peggy Jo was 40 years old. And her wild child days were long behind her. She was working for the Pony Express Courier Service, driving a van in Dallas, driving up and up the interstate, delivering packages to businesses. And she and her mother had moved to a new apartment in Garland, another suburb of Dallas. This one was closer to her niece, Michelle, and her family. At that point, Peggy Jo's sister, Nancy, had moved to East Texas, and she and her brother, Pete, had had a falling out, and they weren't really speaking. But she and her niece, Michelle, were really close, and so this kept her closer to them. Over the next few years, Peggy Jo had medical problems of her own to deal with besides taking care of her mother. She hurt her back at work and had to undergo an emergency mastectomy, which kept her bedridden for quite a few weeks. She had also started taking anti-anxiety medication because of the worry that she had about paying for all of her mother's medical bills. You see, the thing was, is everything that she made went towards those costs. And she also really didn't want her mother to have to go to a nursing home. One, it would be very expensive. But also, she told people that she wanted her mother to be in comfort in her own home, in her own bed, and not have to go somewhere else. So this was very, very important to Peggy Jo to be able to take care of her mother and keep her at home with her. But the problem was, is it was getting harder and harder for her to make ends meet. But Peggy Jo liked to take care of other people. She didn't want people to take care of her, so she was too proud to ask her friends and family for financial help. Her friend Cherry told Texas Monthly that she thought that Peggy Jo had gotten to an age where she felt like life was passing her by. This wasn't the life that Peggy Jo had envisioned for herself, and she was far from the beaches of Mexico like she had planned. She was getting stir crazy. You know, having a job that's not very exciting, you're older, it's not glamorous, you go every day, you come home, it's just you and your mom. And, you know, I'm sure it did seem very dull and that like Peggy Jo had just sort of let things go. In 1991, Peggy Jo decided to let her wild child out again, but this time it would shock her friends and family and the FBI. One morning in May, Peggy Jo woke up, made her bed like she always did, and then went in to wake up her mother, just like always. She wrapped a robe around her mother's shoulders, led her into the kitchen, and fixed her breakfast for her. Peggy Jo gave her her medicine and then sat down at the table to visit with her while her mother ate. Peggy Jo didn't like to eat early in the morning, so she would usually sit down with her mother, visit, smoke a cigarette, and drink a soda. After Helen was finished eating, Peggy Jo took her mother back to her bedroom and got her situated in her bed. She fluffed the pillows behind her head, got her a glass of water, and put her book on the bedside table. Peggy Jo then went back into her bedroom and started getting dressed for the day. But instead of her usual khaki pants and button-down shirt, the 46-year-old put on something different. She got a pair of men's pants and a men's shirt out of the bottom drawer of her dresser. And then she went into her closet, grabbed a brown men's leather jacket, and she put the clothes on, stuffed the shirt with some towels to give herself a paunchy stomach, and then next she slipped on a pair of men's cowboy boots that were too big for her feet, and then she walked into her bathroom. Peggy Jo applied some adhesive to her face and stuck on a fake beard, and then she put on some gray spray paint in her hair, you know, like the kind you buy at Halloween, to color her hair gray. She put on a big cowboy hat and then a large pair of sunglasses. Her face was completely covered at this point. And then she topped the outfit off with a pair of gloves and a satchel. So to anyone looking at her, there was no distinguishing that she was a woman. Everything was covered up that might give you the thought that she was female and not male. She called out to her mother as she walked down the hall, "Be back in a minute." And then Peggy Jo walked outside, got into her Pontiac Grand Prix, and drove to the American Federal Bank in Irving. She pulled up into the parking lot and walked into the lobby of the bank in her disguise. When Peggy Jo walked up to the teller, she asked Peggy Jo, "How can I help you?" "Sir." Peggy Jo passed a note to the teller that said, "This is a bank robbery. Give me your money. No marked bills or dye packs." The surprised teller gave Peggy Jo all of the money in her drawer. She stuffed the money into her satchel, nodded, tipped her hat, and then turned around, and Peggy Jo walked straight out of the bank. No muss, no fuss. Peggy Jo got into her car and drove straight back to her apartment where her mother was waiting for her lunch. Peggy Jo got undressed and put on her regular clothes and went back to her daily routine. When the FBI looked at the security footage in the bank, they were convinced that they were dealing with a professional male bank robber. Peggy Jo didn't commit any of the usual mistakes that a rookie robber would do. She didn't rush. She didn't get flustered. She didn't call any attention to herself. She didn't turn around and look back. She just walked in, walked out. And then, of course, her disguise completely threw everyone off. Just like her heroes Butch and Sundance, she never carried a weapon, and no one ever got hurt in any of her robberies. Former FBI agent Steve Powell said that she was one of the most skilled bank robbers he had ever come across, and that was his specialty, chasing bank robbers, so he should know. Peggy Jo could get in and out of a bank in 60 seconds. And this was the beginning of a spree of bank robberies for Peggy Jo, and she would fool the FBI for over a year until they caught her in 1992. In December, Peggy Jo put on her same disguise and walked into the Savings of America in Irving. She passed the same note to the teller and walked out of the bank with $1,258. This time, an eyewitness was able to get the license plate on Peggy's car. When the agents tracked down the address that matched the plate, they found a lady sitting in her living room. She told them she hadn't left the house all day. When the agents went outside to check the car, it was not a Grand Prix. It was a red Chevrolet, and the license plate was missing. That's the thing. Peggy Jo was slick. In January of 1992, Peggy Jo hit the Texas Heritage Bank in Garland and was about to walk away with $3,000. In May, she robbed the Nations Bank of Mesquite, that's another suburb of Dallas, and that time she got $5,317. As she was leaving, she handed a stack of bills back to the teller that had a hidden dye pack in it. Like I said, slick. She knew what she was doing. Agent Powell started calling her Cowboy Bob, and he admitted that Peggy Jo Tallis was making him pull his hair out, or at least want to. In September, Cowboy Bob struck again at the First Gibraltar Bank in Mesquite and walked out with a total of $1,772. Again, they tracked the license plate down to the car, and they found it in the driveway, missing its license plate. While the FBI was still working on the robbery at First Gibraltar Bank, they got another call that Mesquite's First Interstate Bank, a mile away, had been robbed by a man in a beard and a cowboy hat. This time, he walked out with $13,706. There was an eyewitness who got the plates, and they traced them to a brown Pontiac Grand Prix registered to a man named Pete Tallis. The agents went to Pete's work in Carrollton, also not far from Dallas, and asked if he owned a brown Pontiac Grand Prix. And he told them yes, that he had given the car to his sister and mother a year or so ago because they couldn't afford a car. When the agents told him that it was used in a bank robbery, he said, "Bullshit, that car won't go fast enough." But here's the thing. Peggy Jo didn't need a fast car. She didn't run any lights. She didn't squeal her tires. When she left those banks, she never called any attention to herself. Pete gave the FBI Peggy Jo's address. When the agents arrived, they saw the car parked in the parking lot. And while they were trying to decide how to go about apprehending Cowboy Bob, an attractive woman in shorts and a t-shirt started walking towards the car. Agent Powell assumed it was Cowboy Bob's girlfriend. They watched her get into the car and drive away so that they could talk to her away from the apartment. The agents didn't want to spook Cowboy Bob. So when Peggy Jo got around the corner and out of eyesight of the apartment, they pulled her over. Agent Powell introduced himself, and Peggy Jo politely said hello and introduced herself as well. She said yes, the car was hers, and that she had driven it earlier today, that morning to be exact, to buy fertilizer at the plant nursery. Agent Powell checked the trunk, and there was the fertilizer, just like Peggy Jo said there was. He asked her if they could look around her apartment, and for just a split second, Peggy Jo paused. But she relented, and she said, "Well, there's no one in the apartment besides my mother, who's sick." She told the agents, okay, though, they could go into her apartment and look around. Well, the FBI agents rang the doorbell. When Helen answered the door, she was shocked as the agents burst into the door and came rushing in with their guns drawn. In fact, Helen screamed as they ran by her. They went straight down the hall to Peggy's room, and as usual, her bed was perfectly made. Everything was neat as a pin. At first glance, it looked like Cowboy Bob had disappeared on him again. But Agent Powell started looking around the room, and something in the top of Peggy Jo's closet caught his eye. He noticed a styrofoam head with a cowboy hat sitting on top of it and a beard pinned to the face. Then he walked over and looked under Peggy Jo's bed. He found a big bag of money. Agent Powell looked at Peggy Jo and said, "Come on, Peggy Jo, you're hiding a man from us." Peggy Jo looked at him and replied, "There isn't any man, I can promise you that." As Agent Powell looked closer at Peggy Jo, though, he noticed that she had small pieces of glue stuck to her upper lip. And then he noticed that there was a little bit of gray dye in her hair. And then it all came together. He couldn't believe it. He was looking at Cowboy Bob. Peggy Jo was read her rights, and then they took her downtown to the FBI office. When he got to the office, Agent Powell told the others, "Gentlemen, Cowboy Bob is actually Cowboy Babette." When the press got wind of it, they went crazy with the story. They tracked down all of Peggy's family, trying to get the story out of them, but they wouldn't talk to them. Partly because they had no idea any of this was going on and had no idea why Peggy Jo was going around robbing banks, but also they wanted to respect Peggy Jo's privacy. Agent Powell was hoping that he would get Peggy Jo to talk with him and explain what made her decide to start robbing banks in the first place and why she didn't take the time to steal a new license plate for this last bank robbery that she did. Why do two in a day? Why rush it? And then why not steal that license plate? He said, you know, if she hadn't have broken her pattern, he probably wouldn't have caught her, and she might have gotten away with it altogether. But Peggy Jo wouldn't say a word. She wouldn't say why she did it. Her court-appointed attorney hired a psychologist to evaluate Peggy Jo, and this psychologist specialized in evaluating criminals. Peggy Jo did finally admit to him that she had started robbing banks to pay for her mother's medications. She couldn't afford them anymore. She also said that she didn't have any intentions of doing any more after that. So when he asked her why she kept going, Peggy Jo just shrugged her shoulders and stared at the wall. She just kept shaking her head. She never said another word. The psychologist didn't know what to make of Peggy Jo. He was used to hardened criminals talking with him, not nice, well-spoken ladies who sat down and crossed their legs and were polite and knew how to behave themselves. He was flabbergasted. Well, since no one was hurt during any of her robberies, and this was totally out of character for Peggy Jo, she received a 33-month sentence. Peggy quietly did her time, and when she got out, she moved her mother to a new townhome in Garland. At one point, a crime writer even approached her about a novel, but she said, I don't want to embarrass my family, and I just want to move on with my life. That could have made her a lot of money and made it where she could support her family and not have to worry about it. But she said she didn't want all of that out there at the embarrassment of her family. So by this time, when Peggy Jo got out of prison, Helen's disease had really progressed, and her hands shook so badly that she wasn't even able to hold her own silverware anymore. So every night, Peggy fed her mother, gave her a bath, and put her to bed. Then Peggy Jo would go into her bedroom and eat alone and watch nature documentaries on the Discovery Channel until late into the night. It really sounds like a lonely existence. Peggy Jo worked several jobs, and then she went to work as a cashier at the Harbor Bay Marina. She sold bait, coolers, you know, fishing equipment and supplies at Lake Ray Hubbard near Dallas. She was one of their best employees, the manager said. Peggy Jo took the time to not only wait on the well-off customers, but she also made sure to check on her poorer customers too. She would help them out if they were short on money. And when they were trying to buy some supplies, she would offer suggestions on things that didn't cost as much, but were still just as good. She liked to help everyone out. One of their customers was deaf, and Peggy Jo would write notes so that she could ask him questions and help him out whenever he came to shop. When her boss asked Peggy Jo why she was so nice to everyone, Peggy Jo replied, "Well, we all got a past, you know." Sometimes one of the men in the store would ask Peggy Jo out, but she always smiled politely and turned them down. She said that she had to get home to take care of her mother. Peggy Jo slowly lost touch with her old friends, Cherry and the others. Her sister Nancy passed away from breast cancer, and then in December of 2002, Helen passed away as well in her sleep at the age of 83. Peggy Jo was crushed at losing her mother. At the funeral, Peggy Jo and her brother Pete made amends. She started spending time with his family. In the spring of 2004, Peggy Jo bought a Frontier RV. She told her boss that it was time for her to move on, and she was going to get some money together and head to South Padre or maybe on further south to Mexico. She had always wanted to live at the beach. She told her boss that she ought to come too before life ran out on both of them. I feel like that was a theme in Peggy Jo's life, that she was always feeling like life was passing her by, and in some ways it kind of did. I know that living alone with her mother, taking care of her, that wasn't what she had envisioned for herself. Then Peggy Jo sold all of her furniture in the townhouse, and she sold an old Volvo that she'd been driving around. She gave some of her potted plants to the neighbors, then she hopped in her RV and drove off. For a while, she stayed at a local park near Lake Ray Hubbard. She spent the day fishing and bird watching. Her niece Michelle and her brother Pete would come out to visit her. She would make them fajitas for dinner. They'd look at old family photos and visit about things that had happened in the past. One evening, a friend drove out to check on her, but Peggy Jo was gone. No one knew where she had gone to. She never told anyone. She didn't tell them about her plans. But she would sporadically call from payphones, checking in, letting her family know that she was okay and making sure that they were okay too. On May 5th, 2005, Peggy Jo got up, made her bed like she did every morning, and then, instead of her usual button-down shirt and khaki pants, she put on a long-sleeve black shirt and a pair of black pants. She put on some lipstick and some blush, and then she brushed through her hair. She picked out a large black straw hat and a pair of large black sunglasses. Most of her face was completely covered. She got into the driver's seat of her RV, and she drove to Tyler and parked in the Jack in the Box parking lot across the street from the Guaranty Bank. Peggy Jo crossed the street and walked into the bank with a black satchel and said to the teller, "This is a robbery. I need all of your money. Don't set any alarms." The teller gave Peggy Jo everything in her drawer, $11,241. She was home free now. This was enough money to get Peggy Jo to Mexico and live that life on the beach that she had always dreamed of. But this time Peggy Jo made a mistake. I don't know if it was nerves or if she just thought this was it or what, but she didn't check for a dye pack like she usually did. And as she left the bank, the dye pack exploded. Red smoke plumed out of her black satchel as she walked outside, and all of the money was covered in red dye. It was ruined. A couple saw her, and they recognized what was going on. They called 911, and then they started following Peggy Jo. Y'all, their kids were in the car. And they decided that they would follow Peggy Jo as she drove off in her RV. They told their kids, "Keep your heads down, kids." I mean, I guess they were caught up in the moment, but I can't imagine tailing a bank robber. How do you know they're not going to shoot you? Anyway, there were two FBI agents out in Tyler that morning, and so it didn't take long for them to locate Peggy Jo trying to get away in her RV either. Of course, an RV is not a speed wagon, so it was hard for her to even get up at much speed to get going very far at all. Tyler police were also dispatched, and the Texas State Troopers were called in as well. They followed Peggy Jo down the highway to the outskirts of town, and she made one last-ditch attempt to get away by turning her RV into a subdivision right on the outside of town. But the police made the block and came over and boxed her in on the other way. And that was it. Law enforcement from all agencies climbed out of their vehicles wearing their bulletproof vests. Some were holding handguns, and others had rifles. They had no idea who was in that RV. All they knew was that it was someone who was suspected of robbing a bank, and they assumed it was more than one person. They had already been tracking three men that were suspected of robbing several banks, so they thought it could possibly be them or some other gang of people. They called out, "Come out, you're surrounded, make it easy on yourself." They stood there nervously. The curtains were drawn, they couldn't see inside. And after the fact, it was assumed that Peggy Jo must have sat there while the agents stood outside and smoked one last cigarette, because there was an ashtray on the table and a cigarette that had been recently put out. Peggy Jo picked up a toy pistol and opened the door, her hands at her side. The officers were shocked. It was a 60-year-old woman who opened the door. She could have been some of their grandmothers. "Ma'am, you don't have to do this," one of the officers called out to her. Peggy Jo looked at him and said, "You mean to tell me if I come out of here with a gun and point it at y'all, you're not going to shoot me?" Please don't do that, ma'am," another officer called out to her. Peggy Jo stepped out of the RV, and this time, the gun in her hand became visible. Now, it was a toy, but from far away, the officers couldn't tell that. It was assumed that she had bought it just in case she ever wanted to use it in a robbery. Still wouldn't hurt anyone, but it was real enough looking to fool people. The agents ask her again, "Please, ma'am, please stop." But Peggy Jo just kept walking towards them. She was shot 4 times. Peggy Jo fell forward, and when she hit the ground, she took her sunglasses off, closed her eyes, and died. Peggy Jo was not planning on going back to prison. Peggy Jo's family were shocked. They had no idea that she'd gone back to robbing banks. It was later proven that Peggy Jo had actually committed several other bank robberies in the area, too, in the past year. The family held a service for her in Kaufman. They still couldn't understand why she'd been robbing banks. What had possessed her to do this? But one thing they did know, she went out doing what she loved and on her own terms, just like her heroes, Butch and Sundance. Thank you for listening today. I know that it's not right to root for a bank robber, but I kind of wish that Peggy Jo had ridden off into the sunset and at least finally gotten to live on the beach like she'd always wanted. Let me know what you think. Do you think maybe it would have been okay for Peggy Jo to get away, or should she have gone back to prison? Anyway, thanks for listening today, you guys. I appreciate you putting up with my technical difficulties and being patient with me. Hopefully next week will be less of a problem and we'll be on time. If you'd like to reach out and let me know what you think about Peggy Jo, give me some new ideas, or just drop a line, you can send me an email at texastruecrimepodcast@gmail.com. You can find me on Instagram at texastruecrimepod, or you can find me on Facebook at Texas True Crime. I look forward to seeing you next week. If you like what you're hearing and it makes your ears happy, would you please hit that little subscribe button so you never miss any more episodes, whether they're late, early, or on time. Sorry. Also, please leave a 5-star review, because when you leave those good reviews for me, when someone searches for a true crime podcast out of Texas, it puts it up at the top. The better the reviews, the easier it is to find the podcast. And as always, share it with a friend. I appreciate all of you. Thanks for listening. And I will see you again next week. Bye.